You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the NCAA men's basketball tournament kicks off tomorrow, and a lot of fans are finishing their brackets. We'll find out how the power of math can help us make smarter picks. Now, a state task force on water quality in Wisconsin kicked off its work today with its first hearing at the Capitol. The task force was prompted after a January report showed widespread contamination of private wells in southwestern Wisconsin. And it comes as places like Milwaukee continue efforts to reduce exposure to lead in drinking water through lead pipes. Representative Todd Novak is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 51st Assembly District, which includes Dodgeville, Mineral Point, and Darlington. He's also the chair of the state's Water Quality Task Force. Representative Novak, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, before we get to today's hearing, this is an issue that hits home for you. Some of those wells studied in that report I just mentioned in your district, right?
Correct. This kind of all started in southwest Wisconsin, the idea for the task force. There's a study going on right now in Iowa, Lafayette, and Grant counties, which myself and Representative Travis Tranel represent. The initial report came back that out of the 306 wells sampled in those three counties, 42% had some form of a contaminant at different levels. So it raised a concern with Representative Tranel and I, and we were like, we need to get on this. We need to find out what's going on. We asked Speaker Voss to form a task force to study water quality issue, which he immediately granted, and appointed 16 members, bipartisan, includes some senators and assemblymen, of course, Republicans and Democrats. We kicked her off today, so it was a good day.
What were some of the big themes in today's kickoff hearing?
Well, what we did today is we had all they had DNR testify, we had DADCAP testify, we had Department of Health and Services testify, we also had the state geologist Ken Bradbury testify, and as I started the hearing today, I told all the members, I said, let's start this off like we don't know about water, and we're going to listen to the agencies and the scientists and the geologists, and they're going to teach us about water and what's going on in the state of Wisconsin. They did a fantastic job. The DNR did a great job explaining what they do, what they're seeing. The DADCAP explained in depth the programs and that they deal with farmers and what they're seeing. And of course, DHS talked about health concerns, and then the state geologist went over the whole state. What the state looks like, groundwater. The tricky part about water in the state of Wisconsin is that there's no geographic area of the state's the same. So, for example, in my area, our problems down there may be different than north. So one thing we're going to do, we have another Madison hearing in a couple weeks where we're going to bring in some stakeholders, conservation groups, and farm groups. Then we're going to fan out. We're going to have 11 hearings across the state of Wisconsin over the next few months. So it's a big task, but I think we're all up to it.
Given that you're right, there are different issues facing different parts of the state, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges in terms of contaminants that you're tackling in this task force?
You know, right now they did a broader overview this morning, and they talked about lead pipes and just pretty much everything, just to kind of give us a basic of some issues. And they also did a really good job talking about some good things that are going on that communities are doing, some farm lead conservation groups are doing. And so it was kind of a balanced report. But I think where this is going to narrow down based on what I'm hearing today, there's so much out there. I think we're going to be getting into the quality issue of water and probably a little bit of quantity as we head up north. So that's probably where the focus is going to head. But at this point, we're looking at everything. The speaker has told me that if, he wants legislation out of this when we're done. He said if need be, if we need to go further into some different issues, then he will reconvene the task force next session also. So,
talking to Representative Todd Novak, Republican from Wisconsin's 51st Assembly District, including Dodgeville, Mineral Point, and Darlington. He's chair of the state's Water Quality Task Force. One issue that's come up a lot is farm runoff, especially with larger animal operations, manure getting into groundwater, depending on the geology and vulnerable areas. People have accused the state legislature of kind of being reluctant to tackle that issue head on. What are you looking at when it comes to farm runoff?
Well, you know, and that we discussed that a little bit today. And I wouldn't say reluctant. I think forming a task force is a huge step. I see what's going on now is the Republicans. This isn't a Republican or Democrat issue. This is a state of Wisconsin issue, and it's really climbed up the ladder in top concerns in the state of Wisconsin, and now is a concern of both parties. So, which I think will help move things along, and so I'm really excited about that. You know, there's no reluctance on this bipartisan committee. Everybody here is serious, and they want to come up with some solutions and some guidance, and we're going to look at everything.
You also mentioned not just water quality, but water quantity. Another issue we've seen is the state's ability to regulate high-capacity wells, to consider the overall impact of multiple wells on things like trout farms and other water sources that people depend on for recreation and for water. Is that something you're going to be tackling?
I'm assuming, you know, we're going to be going up in the Central Sands region, and that's where that's a big, mm-hmm. bigger issue, and that will be part of our conversation up there. So definitely, I think one thing we need to remember, and the state geologist testified this today, Wisconsin has an abundance of good water. He showed a map of the water, aquifers, and we have a lot of water. Now our goal is to protect it. I think that's an important part that we need to remember, too.
Now, when are you hoping to have legislation to bring before the full Assembly and Senate?
Well, you know, we're going to have 11 hearings. We're going to start in the South. You know, for example, one of our locations will be Lancaster. I think Janesville, Racine, and we're going to keep moving north. We're going to end up in Superior. A few of these hearings, we're going to hold one in one city one day and another area the next. So I'm hoping to have this done by the end of summer, at least the hearing portions. And we're going to have a report written and then go from there. So I look for maybe towards the end of the session to have legislation, maybe a day of just a session day of water issue or water bills. So that's the goal. And I think we're going to have do some more work next session. This is a huge issue. And as we know, and we found out today in our hearing, this just did not happen overnight. This has been going on for generations. So solutions can't be developed just overnight either. So I think that's important to remember.
Representative Novak, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for asking. Thank you very much.
That was State Assembly Representative Todd Novak, who represents the 51st Assembly District, including Dodgeville, Mineral Point, and Darlington. He's chair of the state's Water Quality Task Force. He was with us today to talk about priorities for that task force just after it wrapped up its first informational hearing this afternoon. Coming up, filling out a March Madness bracket can involve a lot of guesswork. We'll find out how math can make things easier on us. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a UW engineering professor about the system she's devised to fill out a March Madness bracket. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
Trout fishing conjures an image of sparkling sunlight reflecting on a rushing stream, and a fisherman in hip boots confidently whipping his pole and casting a line into the moving water. Early trout season, which is catch and release only, runs from January until early May. That image is a little bit different. Ron Davis paints us this picture of a father and son trout fishing expedition in March.
It was futile. A stinging March wind gusting across Timber Cooley Creek and my cataract clouded eyes made threading a hair-thin tippet into the eye of a trout fly no larger than a peppercorn practically impossible. I thought wistfully of the warm car and thermos of coffee waiting up on Olstad Road. My son, Kellen, perhaps sensing my impending retreat, sloshed up the creek. "Having a problem?" he asked. "Yes, I was having a problem, but it was nothing that magically wiping away 30 of my 65 years wouldn't fix. Here, let me do that." He quickly tied off the fly, then said, "Cast right there, just behind those rocks." While he watched, I tried some self-conscious false casts and rolled the line down. It was immediately clear I'd wind-knotted my leader into a little mess of monofilament around the tiny nymph, rendering my offering to any trout looking for breakfast preposterous. I reeled in and began playing cat's cradle with the tangled web. My son rolled his eyes and held out his hands. He untangled the knots, deftly looped my fly into the eddy behind a pile of field stones, and handed me my rod. Soon I splashed out a little brookie. The inevitable reversal had happened. Child had become father to man. As Callan headed back downstream, I remembered taking him trout fishing for the first time. It was the May opener. He was 9, and I'd roused him before dawn with the promise of donuts and hot chocolate. We bumped a few miles west on Nottleson Road in my old pickup to the upper reach of Peterson Creek, narrow enough at that point to jump over with a few running steps. Blundering down through the muck and emerging skunk cabbage, I showed Callan how to point his rod backwards to avoid snagging in the tag alders that clawed at our jackets and pants. I cautioned him to walk softly. Browns and brookies hiding in the undercut bank spooked easily. In the gathering dawn, I skewered on a half of a nightcrawler we'd pilfered in the backyard the night before, and I tried to explain how to gently flip the split-shotted rig just up from the undercut so the current would push it under, out of sight, where the fish lived. His first effort was clumsy and left the worm in plain sight on the sandy bottom. But I was shocked to see a nice trout flash out, grab it, and dart back under the bank. "He's got it! Pull him out!" With one of my hands on the rod, we lifted and swung Kellen's first trout into the grassy hummocks behind us. Back on the timber coulee, I continued lunging up and down the slippery banks on a bad knee, snagging flies in overhanging branches and spooking trout after trout with my ridiculous impersonation of a fly fisher. Mumbling, grumpy responses to any offers of help, I had to wonder why Kellen would want to take this old man fishing. Later, though it pained me, I muttered a begrudging thank you for his nursemaiding me around. "Hey," he said, "how many times have you done the same for me?" Of course, he was right, but somehow the return for those kindnesses is not something I'd ever sought or ever thought I'd need.
Ron Davis is a retired English teacher, a freelance writer, and a columnist for BMW Owners News. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, the NCAA Men's College Basketball Tournament gets into full swing tomorrow. That means those of us filling out a bracket have less than a day left to make those predictions. Some people use their gut reactions to pick winners. Others go by their favorite schools or their mascots. But for those of us wanting to eliminate as much guesswork as we can, maybe some mathematical modeling can be a good place to turn. Laura Albert is an associate professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. She also directs the Badger Bracketology Sports Analytics team. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So how does an engineering professor get into bracketology?
Well, engineering is pretty data-driven these days. My research is no exception. My specialty is operations research and analytics. So in my research, I apply mathematical methods and advanced analytics to solve engineering problems and to make better decisions. Most of my research focuses on public sector problems and emergency response and homeland security. And analytics, or sports analytics, is a fun way to explore different aspects of the things I do every day.
So how do we use some of that mathematics in something like the NCAA championships?
Sure. I started Badger Bracketology a few years to tinker around with sports analytics, learn some new skills on my own, and also have a lot of fun, and it is fun. And it helps me bring sports analytics into the classroom, which is really engaging for a lot of students. I got started with the college football playoff, both ranking the teams and then simulating the rest of the season to forecast who might get into the playoffs. And I also rank the men's NCAA basketball team during the season.
And you use something called Markov chains when you do some of this bracketology. This is not a sports-only kind of math. Explain for a layperson like me what that is.
Sure. A Markov chain is a mathematical model that helps us understand how a system evolves over time. So it's widely used in financial engineering applications, queuing theory, and epidemiology. So it has a lot of actual applications, not just sports analytics. But in this case, we're trying to understand how our system, which is a basketball league or a football league, evolves over time. And that can be used to help rank the sports teams. And what it does is it really helps us focus on the structure, like who plays who, and that structure of matchups over the course of a season. And it takes that into account to endogenously determine things like strength of schedule, and that helps us rank the sports team. So we use data, we use structure, and that helps us understand who might be the best sports team without a lot of data, actually.
So what data are you shoveling into the data burner, if I can use a coal metaphor, to come out with this product, your ultimate predictions and picks?
I use some pretty simple data, and that actually helps me bring it into the classroom for my students who think football is another sport. I actually just look at the games that are played, where they're played, if it's at a home game or an away game, and I look at the scores and the score differential.
That's it. That's pretty simple.
It's pretty simple, and it's amazing. It's actually quite beautiful to see the mathematical rankings so closely match those of an expert with so few data points.
Interesting. And now, how successful are these rankings? When you look at head-to-head matchups between two teams you've compared, is this predictive? I know any given Sunday for football, anybody can win any given game, but how successful is this kind of analysis in predicting games?
Sure. I do some prediction for the college football season, looking ahead of time, and it's fairly accurate. I'm able to look a few weeks ahead of time who might get into the college football playoff based on not only the games that they've played, but their path to the playoff, which is the remaining schedule, and that's critically important. If I built a more sophisticated model, I can improve the predictions a little bit more.
But we're probably never going to be at a point where we can run the math at the beginning of the tournament and come up with the perfect bracket. There's a lot of permutations there.
Right. Mathematical models and analytics can help us bound the uncertainty, but it can't tell us exactly what's going to happen ahead of time.
We're talking to Laura Albert, Associate Professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering at UW-Madison. She directs the Badger Bracketology Department, Sports Analytic Team. We're talking about using math to analyze sports and using sports to illuminate concepts in math. And let's talk about that point. You mentioned that this is a fun way to bring students into some interesting and exciting mathematical concepts. Talk about how looking at math through the lens of sports gets those students engaged.
Oh, sure. So I use Markov chains because I think it's the right tool for the job. And I can back up a second from that. Mm-hmm. Markov chains and that idea is the basis for Google's PageRank algorithm. So it's this amazing idea that changed our world. It's very useful. And sometimes lectures about math models can be a little dry. Yeah. And so I try to bring the concept of math into the classroom. I've also used Markov chains to analyze volleyball scoring schemes and figuring out how, or predicting how long a game would last using rally scoring or the old school volleyball scoring. And it's really interesting. Students usually don't need to know or even like sports or really know how they played, but they understand wins and losses. They understand rankings. And it's fun. And then they can go home and tinker with the math themselves if they want.
And I imagine that this is kind of a right tool for the right job situation. So by doing this with sports, then students might be able to develop something for a future in engineering or, I don't know, predicting the spread of epidemics, lots of other fields that could use these mathematical concepts.
That's true. In some of my research on emergency response, I study how to optimally route ambulances and fire engines to calls. And you can think about wrapping an optimization around a Markov chain. And that's something that's very practical and makes a real difference in our lives.
All right. I've kept a lot of people waiting here for the big questions. How's Wisconsin looking in this year's bracket?
Well, they have a 5 seed. I think they're looking pretty good. I think that was the right seed this year. It's always challenging to be a 5 seed because they will have to play a 1 seed in the near future. If they win the first couple of games, it can be tough, a tough route. But I think they're looking pretty good in the first round of the tournament.
And is there a favorite to win it all based on your power rankings?
I have Duke ranked number one. I'd say they're the favorite. But usually the favorite has about a 20% chance of winning the tournament if you look at historic data. And the top four teams, there's like a 50% chance one of the top four teams in the tournament will win the tournament. win the entire tournament, and the other 64 teams split the remaining 50%.
Are there matchups in the first round that tend to have upsets for some reason because of how they select the teams? They're just more upset prone.
Sure. The 5-12 and the 7-10 seem to have the most upsets historically. Huh. But the teams to keep an eye on are the 6-11 matchup. They've produced a lot of Cinderellas, a disproportionate number of the Cinderellas that have made it into the Final Four. And it's hypothesized that the 6-11 matchup goes the longest in the tournament before playing a 1 or a 2 seed. So that idea of that path to the Final Four is very important, and those teams might have a secret advantage.
Hmm. And somebody's probably done this, just taken all the historical brackets, not put in the team names, just where they are in the brackets and figure out which the best positions are to be in. Like, base your bracket based on past performance, just of those numbers.
Sure. The one seed's a great one. We've seen pretty weak one seeds, but again, they might have an easier path to the Final Four. And even if they're seeded off, that the seed itself tells you a little bit about the matchups and who they might play. And that could benefit some teams or be a disadvantage to others.
For people who aren't math majors or engineering majors, what would you say to encourage us to maybe take another look at math, even if we kind of gave up hope on our math careers early on?
I have so many reasons to look at math. I wish people could see all the amazing work that my colleagues and I do, you know, in engineering, and all the ways that it can be used to make a difference. I think people are really surprised that we could about all the different types of applications.
We'll leave it there. Laura, thanks so much for coming up to our studio today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Albert, Associate Professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering at UW-Madison and Director of Badger Bracketology. She was with us to talk about using mathematical systems to make our March Madness picks. Coming up, the teenage years have never been easy, but new studies show that the levels of stress and anxiety experienced by young girls just keep increasing. We'll get some tips on how to support a young or teen girl in your life who might be feeling that way right now. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it can be hard to make important financial decisions, but Kate Archer-Kent's guest has advice on how to sort through the information we have and make a smart choice. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, anxiety has risen among teens and young adults overall, but many studies show that young girls are experiencing the biggest increase in feelings of nervousness, worry, and fear. For parents and educators working with girls, it can be hard to figure out the best way to support them through times of stress or anxiety. Lisa DeMore is a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with girls. She focuses on the topics of parenting, child development, and education, and writes the monthly Adolescence column for the New York Times. Her new book is called Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
We'll talk more about this rise in stress and anxiety for girls. You write that both anecdotally in your own practice and then in the research that's out there. We're seeing this big increase.
We are. What we know right now is that 31% of girls are reporting symptoms of anxiety compared to 13% of boys. So, you know, quite a substantial difference between boys and girls. And there was a study done that showed that between 2009 and 2014, there was a 55% jump in the number of girls who said that they felt worried, nervous, or fearful often, whereas there was no jump in that same measurement for boys. So there's something going on with the girls, though there are plenty of boys who do themselves feel anxious.
Now, it's a lot of bad news, it sounds like, but you highlight some good news, that there's help out there. That's where we're going to spend most of our time. And you start with the idea that stress and anxiety in and of themselves aren't necessarily bad things. What do you mean by that?
So the reason I wrote this book, Under Pressure, was first of all because of how much people were talking about high levels of stress and anxiety in their kids. And then second, because how psychologists understand stress and anxiety has grown pretty far apart from how the culture understands stress and anxiety. So right now, when people in the popular culture talk about stress and anxiety, they tend to talk about it always as if it's harmful or bad. Whereas my colleagues and I have long understood that stress and anxiety are normal and healthy functions. You know, stress is what happens when we are growing and adapting to new, you know, even difficult situations. And anxiety alerts us to threats. It helps us pay attention and helps us stay safe.
And that seems like a really important point, because if we take stress and anxiety as just inherently negative, we might say the solution is to completely avoid situations that cause stress and anxiety. And that, as you return to in the book a lot, that isn't necessarily the best answer.
Well, that's exactly right. So the first thing that happens if we see stress and anxiety as always harmful or damaging is that we then become stressed about being stressed or anxious about being anxious, which I think might account for some of the rising levels we're seeing, is that we're in fact exacerbating the problem by seeing it as a problem. But as you mentioned, the other thing that happens is that we can then feel compelled to go out of our way to avoid things that make us feel stressed and anxious. And one thing we know is that avoidance tends to make anxiety in particular worse. That when people avoid the things they fear, two things happen. The first thing that happens is they feel tremendous relief. So, you know, imagine that I'm afraid of dogs. If I see a dog coming toward me as I walk down the street, the first thing that will happen is I'll have a strong anxiety response, which is uncomfortable. You know, my heart will start to race, my breathing will change, I might sweat. And if I cross the street, I'll actually feel a lot better really fast. So we actually call that a reinforcing experience. It reinforces my wish to cross to avoid dogs. The next thing that happens is that I never meet a nice dog, that dogs all remain equally terrifying in my mind. So our instinct is to avoid, but one of the real principles of psychology is that avoidance actually feeds anxiety.
That reminds me of a perfect example from your book. You talk about a student you worked with who came in very upset, very worried. She had a chemistry test coming up toward the end of the day. Her solution was to try to get you to get her out of it or get a parent to come in and sign her out. What did you work with to have a more productive approach to that so that it didn't reinforce that anxiety for her?
So I have the honor of spending 2 days a week consulting at a school, and then the rest of my week is spent at my private practice. And indeed, as you describe, I had a girl come in, and she was in a total panic about an upcoming chemistry test. And we were having this conversation where she's just like, I can't do it. And then she had the thought, what if I can get my dad to come get me? And I just saw in that moment, I just watched the anxiety drain away. And that's when I remembered, like, that's right, that's, we cannot do this, right? If she leaves, she's not going to want to come back, or she's going to have the same exact thing happen the next time she has a chemistry test. So I did what we know to do, which is to help her move toward the test, right? So I didn't say, like, go take it, run at it, you know, go give it everything you've got. That tends not to work. But I did try to think about sort of small steps she could take to consider making the test more tolerable. So I said, you know, can you check in with your teacher? Can you take a crack at the test and see how it goes? You know, maybe you won't do as well as you want, but maybe there's points you can make up later. And this is what we know, that when people are fearful, the best thing that can happen, you know, in technical terms, we call it graduated exposure. In everyday language, they have to sort of take baby steps towards the feared thing. And we can help people manage their anxiety as they move towards the feared thing. But if they run away from it, it usually becomes more frightening over time.
Talking to Lisa DeMore, author of the book Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. We've talked a little bit about the positive side of stress and anxiety. Lisa, when does it become a negative? When is stress too much stress or too much anxiety?
So with stress, here's how we know when it's sort of crossed from healthy to unhealthy. Either it's chronic stress, right, where there's the person is feeling stress all the time and getting no relief. Psychologists don't like that. Or traumatic stress. We don't like trauma, anything that overwhelms people. So a good metaphor for thinking about healthy stress versus chronic stress is that in some ways healthy stress is like weightlifting. When we lift weights, we purposely stress our muscle. We work at the edge of our capacity, and it actually causes us to gain strength. Same thing with everyday stress. If I take on a new job, it will be very stressful for me initially, but then I will adapt to it and be able to do things I could not do before. But as with weightlifting, you can't lift weights all the time. You know, there has to be periods of, you know, really stretching and working, and then periods of rest in order to recover. And humans are the same way. We can't take on one new and challenging task after another or deal with, you know, one difficult circumstance after another without getting some respite.
And that's something you look at, that there are a lot of specific causes of stress, but something that can be really pernicious and maybe hard to figure out it's happening to us is when there's that daily drumbeat of stress, whether it's living in a noisy, dangerous neighborhood or constant homework, crowded schedules, things like that. How do we even realize that we have too much day-to-day stress?
I think that if we really start to feel ourselves worn down, right, if we really start to feel that we are just on fumes, you know, kind of, you know, barely managing, kind of getting through day-to-day, that tells us that we're actually not growing from the stress anymore, that it has tipped over into being, you know, taxing on us as opposed to growth-giving. Like, we typically, ideally, would want to see stress as something that causes us to sort of build our durability, build our abilities over time. For anxiety, the way we know that it has become problematic is if it turns into an alarm that doesn't make sense. So ideally, our anxiety alarm is useful, you know, that we become anxious, say, when we're driving and somebody near us is driving erratically, we should feel anxious in response to that. That will alert us to pay attention and to make a change. Same thing, so it can alert us to outside threats. It can also alert us to inside threats. You know, so if we are procrastinating and start to feel anxious because we're not getting to our work, that's anxiety alarm sort of working as it should. What we don't want to see is when the alarm breaks. So it might mean that the alarm goes off all the time for no reason, right? That's problematic. Or the alarm is way out of proportion to the event. So I don't want to see kids having panic attacks over minor quizzes. You know, that doesn't make sense. So that's how we can know that anxiety has gotten out of control. But even when it does, psychologists really understand the principles of anxiety, and we really know how to treat it, often without medication. So people don't need to feel helpless about anxiety, even if it feels like it's crossed into the unhealthy range.
Right. Suppose a parent of a teen girl, say, is listening right now. They're hearing these numbers, a big increase in anxiety and stress among girls their kids' age. How do they notice it? How do they detect it? It's not always, I think, immediately clear to, say, a parent.
I think that sometimes kids will just say it. You know, I feel so anxious. I feel so stressed. You'll hear this a fair bit from kids. But if kids aren't talking about it but are feeling high levels of stress and anxiety, often what will come up is that they have trouble sleeping, or they're having lots of stomach aches, or they're really, really fragile, you know, emotionally fragile. So they're not saying the words that they feel stressed and anxious, but they fall apart easily. Those can be times when parents can know that something is really wearing on their kids.
And how can the parent then make an approach that won't get a defensive reaction, or just to get a, yeah, I'm fine, whatever?
Well, I think that, you know, if a child is suffering and the parent sort of says, are you okay? Is everything all right? And the child says, no, I'm fine. You know, parents can do a couple different things with that. You know, one thing may be that the child is saying, you know, I've got this. Like, yes, I am outwardly upset, but actually I think I can handle it. And the parent can give the child a chance to do so. If that's not working, a parent can say, look, you know, I love you. I can see that you're in pain. I'm sticking up for you feeling better. I'm here to help you feel better. You let me know what you need. Something like that. I think more often it's that the child feels stressed and anxious and is telling the parent all about it, you know, maybe having a full-on meltdown and coming to the parent for help. And the parent can feel pretty helpless in those moments and pretty overwhelmed. You know, when teenagers have meltdowns, that's a pretty harrowing experience for adults. And I think the way we want to approach those moments in terms of trying to make it better is we want to remember what our instincts told us to do when our kids were little, maybe toddlers, and they fell down and they scraped their knee. You know, the first thing they always do is they look at their knee and then they look at our face. And if we're calm, usually they're calm. And if we panic, they panic. So what I would say to a parent, if they have a child who is really having, you know, a pretty intense emotional experience, is even if the parent's quite uncomfortable, I would like them to empathically underreact, you know, to say, you're going to be okay. I can see you're really upset. Do you want a glass of water? You know, what would help you feel better? But to communicate verbally and otherwise a general confidence that the child will sort of ride this wave and then feel better shortly.
We're talking to Lisa DeMore, clinical psychologist who specializes in working with girls. Her new book is Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or someone who works with young people, do you see this? Do you see girls, teen, preteen, experiencing high levels of stress or anxiety? If you're a young adult, is this something you can relate to, or a teen yourself? Have you been through this? Where's that stress coming from? How do you handle it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lisa DeMore. She's a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with girls. Her new book is called Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your life as a parent, as a teacher, as a school social worker? What do you see happening with stress and anxiety in the lives of young girls? Do you see this kind of stress and anxiety in their lives maybe more so than we saw in the past? If this is you experiencing this, call in and let us know and how you've tried to deal with it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, in your book, you look at a lot of the different things that can trigger stress and trigger anxiety. One of the things you look at is the role of social media. I think that's probably something a lot of people are thinking about. How does that play into some of these issues?
There's a lot of ways it can. The most, I think, critical way that is actually pretty boring is that it disrupts sleep. A lot of why kids are losing sleep is because they are looking at digital technology either to do their homework or to check in with their friends when they should be sleeping instead. And we do know from the research that today's kids sleep way less than a generation ago. And sleep is the glue that holds human beings together. And that reason alone is why we can see a lot more fragility in kids. So one of the things that we need to recognize is that elementary school students need 11 hours of sleep a night, and middle schoolers need 10 hours of sleep a night, and high schoolers need 9, which very few get. So that's one impact of social media. And then for a lot of kids, it's the comparison question. You know, that when kids are looking at social media, they are often looking at very carefully selected, curated, posed, crafted images that their friends have put up of their lives. And this is also what adults do too. You know, adults don't indiscriminately put up, you know, the whole story of what's going on with themselves. And even though kids know that what they're looking at isn't the whole story, I think it's very hard for them not to feel like they come up short. And the analogy I use in the book is that what people put up on social media is like a furniture showroom. And what we know about our own lives is like the lived-in home of our life. And no lived-in home is ever going to compare favorably to a furniture showroom. And so our job as adults is to do what we can to gently and constantly remind kids, you know, what you're seeing is not the reality, and what you put up is not the reality. But don't compare what you know to be true about yourself with what this person has put up online.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Randy?
I have a six-year-old daughter who on some school days complains about being nervous or anxious, but she's not able to identify what it is that's causing those feelings. I'm wondering if you have any insights into that.
You know, it's tough with six-year-olds because I think it's impressive that she can say, I'm feeling nervous or anxious, but she may not be able to put her finger on it. So one thing that is true, especially of six-year-olds, this isn't true of every age, but at 6 years old, they are highly aware of right and wrong and rules. And they can be very rigid in their understanding of right and wrong. And the reason for this developmentally is that up until about age six, for kids, conscience lives on the outside, meaning that if you do something wrong and nobody sees you, you're good to go. But then at 6, what happens is that kids start to get an internal conscience, which is a good thing. But the first version of it tends to be very, very rigid. It's sort of like you've either committed a capital crime or you are totally innocent. They don't have a really nuanced sense of right and wrong. So 6-year-olds can be pretty tense because they can do something small, like spill their milk and have this, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. Or often they do it and they blame somebody else right away because it feels like such a big deal. So 6-year-olds often benefit when we help them have a more nuanced understanding of mistakes. And a great phrase to have on hand, really at all ages, but 6-year-olds are really sort of the, you know, ground zero of this, is to say to them, you know, mistakes come in 3 sizes. They come small, medium, and large. And what a mistake tells you, the size of the mistake tells you how upset you have to be and how much work it's going to take to fix it. So if you accidentally spill your milk, that's a small mistake. All you have to do, you know, you have to be kind of just a little upset, not even all that much at all, and to fix it, you just clean up the milk. And then you can kind of take it up from there. So as a general thing with 6-year-olds, their anxiety comes down when we help them have a more kind of graduated understanding of right and wrong. But if that's not what it's about for her, another thing that I find works really well is a placebo effect of tea or something else nice to drink. So I'm a mom, and sometimes when my daughters would say, like, I don't feel good, something's not right, I'll say, do you want some tea? And I'll get caffeine, no caffeine, whatever. So I'm looking all busy and active and, like, responsive to the concern while actually not doing anything particularly, you know, specific. And I have often had the experience as a mom that that seemed to be adequate. Like, I was taking it seriously and I was busy, but I was also communicating my sense that this was small enough that the right cup of tea would probably fix it.
That works on me, too. Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Time for one more quick call, I think, from Lisa in Green Bay. Lisa, hello.
Hi. I was just tuning in, and I'm not sure if you guys covered this at all earlier, but I had suffered from anxiety and depression from early on in life, and middle school, high school years, and especially college years were particularly stressful. And I believe personally on my own that it's had some pretty damaging effects on my memory skills over time. High cortisol levels, I've heard, can have a link to that. But I also am a new mom. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I'm constantly worried about how I'm going to try and handle this concept of reducing her stress and anxiety as she grows older. And
Lisa,
so,
thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time. Lisa DeMore, leave us in our last minute with some advice for that mom trying to have a less anxious life for her daughter.
Sure. So it is true, you know, to feel kind of chronically anxious is a workout, right? And it means that there's a lot of stress hormones being dumped into our systems. What I would say is that anxiety is one of the things that clinicians feel most comfortable and most hopeful about treating. And so I would say, you know, that anyone who feels like their anxiety has reached uncomfortable levels should look for help, and even there's fantastic workbooks that are available if a person's not ready to contact a clinician. There's also terrific research showing that when parents have very high levels of anxiety, if they work with a clinician on managing their own anxiety, the chances of them transmitting that anxiety to their children goes way, way down. So even though anxiety can feel incredibly uncomfortable and does sometimes reach really kind of miserable daily levels, I really want people to know that anxiety is not on the list of things that clinicians feel helpless about. There are other things we can describe but not treat, but anxiety is not one of them.
It's a good place to leave it. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lisa DeMore, clinical psychologist. Her new book is Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin State Supreme Court election is less than 2 weeks away. We'll talk to both of the candidates in that race, plus advice on preventing heart attacks and much more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.